Welcome to Poems for Company. I'm your host, Brian Dillon. One previous episode of this show featured poems that imagined the poet's parents before the poet was even born. That episode included Yvonne Boland's account of her father accelerating his courtship of her mother in pre-war France with his unique gift to her, the black lace fan my mother gave me. Philip Levine, in that same episode, wrote about his mother crossing the Atlantic as a 9-year-old girl and arriving in New York, entering a brand new life. Another episode of Poems for Company allowed us to hear the voices of various elderly figures, some of whom spoke to their adult child. For example, Sharon Old's speaker discussed cloning with her 83-year-old mother and how mother and daughter will try to meet on the mother's birthday in the year 3000. It's a delightful poem in which the younger speaker speaks with her elderly mother on the mother's own level, somewhat disconnected from the real world. These episodes, of course, may still be heard by visiting KMUN's podcast page and are available through Spotify and numerous other apps. Today's episode is titled Parents Viewed Unconventionally. In each of today's poems, the speaker comments on one or more parents. A father drives his daughter to a rehab facility. The poem says nothing about what issue the rehab will address. We only hear the father speak four words. The silent daughter defines the tension of their car ride, and we may speculate on the intensity of the father's anxiety and on what he wishes he could say but does not in order to comfort his daughter. The poem refers to the center, uppercase T and C, the center, the generic name for the treatment facility. Also, one line mentions the boot. That's the car trunk. This poem from 2022 is by the young Irish writer Molly Toomey. The Drop-Off by Molly Toomey. Everything's a blur. You don't play Talking Heads, Bob Dylan, talk about work or your iffy stomach. You read the road as if it's encrypted with what a father should say on a drive like this. Should I apologize for your missed appointments, unread emails? There's always someone who needs you more. Mostly I'm sorry that I'm not as happy as you raised me to be. I want to ask the GPS the quickest route to end this silence. When we reach the center, you pull up and go straight for the boot. This is what you know to do, to lift the heavy thing. Tell me to take your good umbrella. You drag my suitcase to the door where the nurse stands with the notepad and clutches your arm. I'll come back soon, you say, but she smiles and says, it's better if you don't. Molly Toomey's The Drop-Off. The thrust of her father's four words, I'll come back soon, straining to be forward-looking and reassuring for his daughter, are abruptly parried by the nurse. It's better if you don't. These are the only italicized statements in the poem. The nurse closes the poem by closing the door on the father's final effort to elicit a warm response from his daughter. The nurse implies, your daughter must concentrate on her serious work of healing. Family visits would be intrusive, unhealthy distractions. Of course, I empathize with the speaker who will be temporarily cut off from her family and who probably dreads the changes she will have to make during her treatment. She can't bring herself to console her father, though the silence between them in the car disturbs her. She recognizes her father looks like he's considering voicing some head-patting, conventional wisdom, but avoids doing so. The poem consists of 8 2-line statements, and the second one says, "You read the road as if it's encrypted with what a father should say on a drive like this." It's curious to me that however uncomfortable the silence in the car may be, it's preferable to what might have been the father's unwanted expressions of support, or what could have been his emotional breakdown. He may be silent in his effort to keep in check his strong emotions, his helplessness. He will lift her heavy bag out of the boot and urge she take his good umbrella. But the situation seriously limits his ability to aid his daughter. She must proceed on her own. Assuming the father is well aware of his daughter's disorder, we may only speculate on what he has already experienced, witnessing her turmoil over the previous months, if not years. The poem allows us, maybe even encourages us, to empathize with both the father and the daughter. This is evident especially in one line that is heavily weighted. "Mostly I am sorry that I'm not as happy as you raised me to be." Embedded in that statement is her admission that he tried to create the circumstances for her to be happy. She's not blaming him for her predicament. Let's hear the poem once more, Molly Toomey's The Drop-Off. "Everything's a blur. You don't play Talking Heads, Bob Dylan, talk about work or your iffy stomach. You read the road as if it's encrypted with what a father should say on a drive like this. Should I apologize for your missed appointments, unread emails? There's always someone who needs you more. Mostly I'm sorry that I'm not as happy as you raised me to be. I want to ask the GPS the quickest route to end this silence. When we reach the center, you pull up and go straight for the boot. This is what you know to do. To lift the heavy thing. Tell me to take your good umbrella. You drag my suitcase to the door, where the nurse stands with the notepad and clutches your arm. I'll come back soon, you say, but she smiles and says, it's better if you don't." This poem is from Molly Toomey's first volume, titled Raised Among Vultures. Other poems in the same volume indicate the speaker must be seeking treatment for an eating disorder. It's curious that this specific poem does not even hint of this. Instead, we're locked in tight on the speaker's unconventional view of her father, which is neither flattering nor harsh. Toomey's speaker is the impetus for the entire poem. Her health crisis, her need to enter treatment, her unwillingness to engage with her father during their drive or their parting. The poem originates from all these circumstances. The speaker in our next poem, also remain silent in the presence of parents and others. She considers herself like a seventh wheel when in their company. That is, she knows she's a tag-along, unnecessary to the smooth functioning of the group, perhaps even seen by some as a kind of burden. The speaker may be hard on herself when she reflects on her role as a child and late teen. But a seventh wheel, all the better to absorb what the others say, how they interact. Her poem takes us up to her late teens in terms of the poem's actions, but also tells us in the opening lines that the circumstances she witnessed occurred many years earlier. From her 2020 volume titled Post-Romantic, this is Kathleen Flanagan's Married Love. All of them are dead now, my father and mother, bedded together under their matching stones, their married friends close by. The crystal and good plates all washed and put away in other homes, no party food left over. My job was to whip the cream for dessert and ride behind on their fishing weekends like a seventh wheel, along with our Airedale, who wore striped socks over his muddy paws in the house. Spirits accelerated toward cocktail hour in the Red Ranch kitchen, where they made big to-dos over their drinks, then feigned concern they might corrupt me. The men stirred the air, clustered at the bar, moved among the women conferring over the bubbling stew. My mother, flushed and pretty as a cornucopia of summer fruit. That September, before college, I joined the happy group on a fly fishing river in Montana and slept on the cottage's fold-out couch. Late one evening, lights doused, I was alone with Mother and one of the men. Not quite uncle, not quite friend, though I newly recognized that he was handsome. I've erased whatever he said that convinced me he'd forgotten I was there. But there I was, afraid to breathe, confused to learn how delicately balanced these practitioners of marriage must be. Then they retired to their separate rooms, though a presence hung in the air, like perfume. Kathleen Flanagan's Married Love. With the lights doused, the speaker's mother converses with a man who is part of another couple who are all staying in a Montana cottage for a fly fishing trip. The man is not quite uncle, not quite friend. The situation is ripe for an exchange of secrets, of intimacies. And the teenage speaker notes her presence on the couch in the dim light is ignored, perhaps a consequence of the adults enjoying one too many cocktails. Nobody's speech is quoted in this poem, which adds to the mysteriousness of the situation described. Here's a compelling sentence, though. I've erased whatever he said that convinced me he'd forgotten I was there. We wonder why she erased from her mind whatever the man said, or even how she might have done this, as the situation seemed so unsettling to her. True, the poem closes by assuring us she witnessed no unfaithfulness between her mother and this other man. While the situation may have seemed like the prelude to further intimacy, it did not occur, at least not on this trip, which may have been the last one where she joined her parents and their friends, as the scene occurs the September before she enters college, and her days of being the seventh wheel may have rolled to their end. Kathleen Flanagan tells us a story that suggests the speaker acquires a slippery insight about her mother, about married love, when she's poised to transition to college and assume an adult role herself. The poem reverses conventional chronology. The speaker's parents and their friends are dead and even buried near one another. The dishware they relied on for all their gatherings scattered now to various homes. And then the poet resurrects them all, animates their socializing, recounts a typical party, and then takes us to their group outing in a Montana cottage. Let's hear Kathleen Flanagan's Married Love once more. All of them are dead now, my father and mother, bedded together under their matching stones, their married friends close by. The crystal and good plates all washed and put away in other homes, no party food left over. My job was to whip the cream for dessert and ride behind on their fishing weekends like a seventh wheel, along with our Airedale, who wore striped socks over his muddy paws in the house. Spirits accelerated toward cocktail hour in the Red Ranch kitchen, where they made big to-dos over their drinks, then feigned concern they might corrupt me. The men stirred the air, clustered at the bar, moved among the women, conferring over the bubbling stew. My mother, flushed and pretty as a cornucopia of summer fruit. That September before college, I joined the happy group on a fly fishing river in Montana and slept on the cottage's fold-out couch. Late one evening, lights doused, I was alone with mother and one of the men, not quite uncle, not quite friend, though I newly recognized that he was handsome. I've erased whatever he said that convinced me he'd forgotten I was there. But there I was, afraid to breathe, confused to learn how delicately balanced these practitioners of marriage must be. Then they retired to their separate rooms, though a presence hung in the air like perfume. Kathleen Flanagan's Married Love. This poem is presented in 20 non-rhyming couplets. The one exception is the final stanza, which consists of two words in one short line. She assures us the two older adults retired to their separate rooms, though a presence hung in the air like perfume. Those two words, like perfume, stand out, stand separate in this poem's formatting. The late night would-be rendezvous of these two older adults evaporates with no trace but just a scent of perfume. And the speaker will carry with her the sense of accelerated spirits that might test or even strengthen the bonds of marriage. The speaker, the unintended witness to the exchange between her mother and another man, notes that at the time she was confused to learn how delicately balanced these practitioners of marriage must be. Consider the attitude of a stepchild toward her two sets of parents. The situation seems to offer so many opportunities for complaint. And that may be true in a conventional poem about being a stepchild. But Ada Limón's joint custody defies such conventions. Before I say more, let's hear Ada Limón's poem, Joint Custody. Why did I never see it for what it was? Abundance. Two families, two different kitchen tables, two sets of rules, two creeks, two highways, two step-parents with their fish tanks, or eight tracks, or cigarette smoke, or expertise in recipes, or reading skills. I cannot reverse it. The record scratched in stopping to that original chaotic track. But let me say, I was taken back and forth on Sundays, and it was not easy, but I was loved each place. And so I have two brains now, two entirely different brains, the one that always misses where I'm not, and the one that is so relieved to finally be home. That's Ada Limón's Joint Custody from her 2022 volume, The Hurting Kind. The speaker opens with the question, a bit of self-scolding. Why did I never see it for what it was? Abundance. She does not claim she was a whiner when her biological family broke up, but at the very least, that she was blind to the advantages of the new family configuration. The speaker's no Pollyanna. She does seem to admit her family's initial rupture was not welcome. She does this in one sentence that may imply unhappiness without specifying the grounds for her unhappiness. I cannot reverse it. The record scratched and stopping to that original chaotic track. That sounds like a disguised way of saying she has memories of her original family unit, but she relies on this curious reference to a record instead of detailing accusations against the adults she knows loved her. Furthermore, she admits her weekly transfer from one family to the other was not easy, though the next line, continuing the same sentence, refuses to let even this legitimate-sounding memory dominate. But I was loved each place. No specific biological parent or step-parent is singled out for attention here. We are to understand the speaker feels most fortunate in the quality of adults who minded her when she was young. She's so grateful. I think her upbeat reflection in this poem is highly unusual. So much personal poetry or confessional poetry recalls disappointments, unfairness, ill treatment. When such a poet shares uncomfortable memories, I'm inclined to value their honesty, to empathize with their challenges, and in some extreme cases, even to feel a bit soiled by their sharing. Ada Limón steers clear of some of these conventional features of personal or confessional poetry. As I reread it, we'll hear again in the poem's second sentence concrete examples of the kind of abundance her stepdaughter situation bequeathed to her. Also, listen for the way in which she concludes her childhood experience set her up to operate with two brains now. Again, this is Ada Limon's joint custody. Why did I never see it for what it was? Abundance. Two families, two different kitchen tables, two sets of rules, two creeks, two highways, two step-parents with their fish tanks, or eight-tracks, or cigarette smoke, or expertise in recipes, or reading skills. I cannot reverse it. The record scratched and stopping to that original chaotic track. But let me say, I was taken back and forth on Sundays, and it was not easy, but I was loved each place. And so I have two brains now, two entirely different brains, the one that always misses where I'm not, and the one that is so relieved to finally be home. Molly Toomey, Kathleen Flanagan, Ada Limon, three contemporary women. Toomey from Ireland, Flanagan from Washington State, Limon, Mexican-American and living in Kentucky. All offer unconventional views of parents. Do they prompt you to reflect on how you evaluate your own parents? What stories do you tell about them? Do you wonder how much your personal judgment colors the narratives you tell about your parents? This and all episodes of Poems for Company can be heard anytime by clicking on KMUN's podcast page or going to one of the many apps that share this show, that air this show. Our theme music is Philip Ahlberg's Going to the Sun from his CD Live from Montana, available at sweetgrassmusic.com. Thanks for listening to Poems for Company.